You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side.
Welcome back to the program. We're having a little bit of some transmitter problem. The feed is a little bit gravelly, but that's okay. It's important that we talk with our next guest and good friend, Dr. Kurt Jefferson, who is, of course, formerly of Westminster College in Fulton, now the Dean of Graduate Education in, I have to say this right, at Spalding University in Louisville. Right, Kurt? Is that right? Louisville? Am I getting it right?
You got it right. Louisville.
And Kurt is an expert, of course, in political science. We've talked at length in the past about European politics, but and the geopolitical situation there, and of course Ukraine. And of course, how's the new book coming along? I know you released a new book this year. Let's talk about that first of all, because it's a real nice tome and a real great summary of things for folks who are interested in the whole global strategic scene.
Yeah, well, thank you, Randy. It's great to be back with you on the show, and greetings from the Bluegrass State in Louisville, Kentucky. Yeah, the book, which is called Contextualizing Security, my colleague at Westminster for many years, Tobias Gibson, and I put it together. It was actually born out of an event they held at Westminster this week called the Hancock Symposium, where I ran it for 10 years, and we essentially brought in about 25 speakers and some big names and government leaders and U.S. senators like Roy Blunt and others who, Senator Blunt, who's stepping down, but is a wonderful guy. He wrote a chapter in the book on actually what we're going to talk a little bit about today, Russia and American foreign policy toward Russia. But they're based on some speeches. Then there's some independently written pieces. Tobias and I wrote a piece on security studies today, looking at economic, social, and political things. And in other parts of the world, and there's a piece on Edward Snowden and some of those kind of things. So it's really focused more on security than kind of the areas that you and I tend to talk about, which is more European history and politics and international politics and how it interfaces with the globe. But it's having a nice reception, and folks I'm talking to, including my own mom and dad, said, hey, it's interesting.
Yeah, well, good. I can't wait to read it. I'm going to get a copy here soon and take a look at it. We've talked about Ukraine. We've talked about, at the start and I guess a few weeks into the thing. I haven't checked in with you since, and because it's been so busy. I know in your world, getting that book out and getting it published this summer. But I'm seeing reports in the last couple of weeks that say that, things are turning around. There's a counteroffensive. Russian troops on the run. They're retreating. They're demoralized. Ukraine putting pressure on in the Kharkiv region. What's the story as opposed to the propaganda coming from Ukraine?
It's an interesting situation. We're at the exactly, Randy, the 6 month mark in the conflict, and it seems, I think, for even the Westerners like us who are listening to the propaganda and other reports coming out of that part of the world, that, you know, we don't know what to believe. But I was doing a little research last night, and from what I can tell, we're looking at, this week was significant, first of all. I mean, Ukraine took back nearly 2,000 square miles of territory in the eastern part of the country, the Donbass area, and essentially has Russia, and Putin and, the forces kind of running with their tails between their legs. Now, I will say we're talking both sides, I think, from all as much as you can verify it, around 200,000 or just under 200,000 troops fighting on both sides. But, I think Putin has really miscalculated here. I think I think of some of the conflicts of the last 50 years, and I was reading an interesting piece in the Financial Times talking a little bit about the Chechen wars of 94 to 96 and 98 to 2000, and these things for Russians were kind of far away, and now this is right up on their border, and you're talking now, I think we're pushing up toward potentially, I think U.S. government estimates around close to 80,000, 70,000 Russian troop deaths, maybe 25,000, 15 to 25,000 Ukrainian troop deaths. Not to make light of those, but I mean, this is a country, a civilization, Ukraine, that's fighting for its existence. And irrespective of what one thinks about both sides, this is the Russians are trying to figure out, are we going to cut bait at some point? I don't think Putin wants to do that. His megalomaniacal side has gotten him in, going in a direction of, I'm going to stick in with this. But what the planners in the Kremlin are saying, look, this is, we're going to need 400,000 troops minimum, conscripted forces to come in and do this. And they're saying we're going to be out of armaments, tanks, artillery by December. So we've got a big problem on our hands. This was a colossal mistake by a narcissist who just did not understand functionally what he was getting himself into, in my opinion.
That's what's interesting. I mean, because I think most of us think, wow, you've got the entire Russian country now in retreat. I mean, and it just sounds like they would have enough troops if there was a, if there was a will, there should be a way. But I guess you hear about people being conscripted to go fight from Russia to go fight, which are, and they're under or untrained. I'm looking at an article here, and this is an editorial by Alexander Motyl, M-O-T-Y-L, professor of political science at Rutgers, who said, like his soldiers, is Putin doomed? And the first line is, Vladimir Putin is kaput. And he cites a letter, an anecdotal letter by a guy named Tarasenko, VV, to his wife. This is for the future. If I should die or be taken prisoner or become a vegetable, written July 17th, very hard to write. I'm crying, but I must. Beloved Laura, tell our son what kind of a dad I was. This is about without armor, without ammunition, without normal weapons. This is our situation. And goes on and on, and I will be forgotten. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's tragic. It sounds like one of those Civil War letters that we read, you know?
Indeed.
And this professor says this is not an anecdote. This is the reality of the Russian on-the-ground troops. Is this really what we're seeing?
You know, I think that there's a couple forces at play here. I think, as much as everybody would like Vladimir Putin, on the Western perspective, would like Vladimir Putin out, I do believe that we have to be very careful of getting into wishful thinking versus empirical thinking. And in spite of, I saw the report that, you know, you had this local district council in the Oblast, yes, around St. Petersburg, coming out, yeah, with a couple of their local counselors condemning Putin and wanting treason charges put forward to him. And I just saw they fined that one of the counselors $780 American dollars, and he's going to be dragged before court for himself being seen as treasonous. But it was interesting that one of the political scientists in Russia said that the response, what's important here isn't so much the resolution, which in the West we would say, oh, you know, Joe Biden's losing his grip on power and he's going to go down, or George Bush is losing his grip on power and he's going to be voted out. Here, she said, hey, this is more about the reaction of Putin to this. If he clamps down too hard, then, you know, the military planners. I don't think there's any question that the military is a fifth column in the government, could step in at some point and foist a coup d'etat on the Kremlin, on Putin. But I don't think we're even close to that. I think he's still got the iron grip on power. But his legitimacy, because this thing's dragging on, because it's hitting the average Russian in the pocketbook, just like the average European on the gas side. And we can talk about that, too, because there's division in Europe, especially in places like Germany, over, hey, we want to keep the Russian gas coming because it's killing our jobs if we don't. So, but back to your point about the poor soldier, which is, you know, I mean, absolutely pulls at the heartstrings. It's horrific. At the end of the day, I do think they put up, you know, these troops that are untrained, untested, not ready to go. Remember, a lot of Ukrainian troops have been trained by U.S. military. So it is, in some respects, a men and boys thing. And then they've had this Wagner Group video of the Wagners trying to recruit prisoners, saying, if you don't go to the front, if you desert, you're going to be executed, etc. that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, to the extent that which that's propaganda from the Ukrainian side is a question in and of itself. But I think you're right. I think it is getting dire for Russia. But the question is, the nationalist right in the Russian government is now saying we need to step up and double down and turn this into a full war front, you know, footing. Whether that takes place or not remains to be seen, and we'll have to just see what King Vlad has to say about that.
Talking with Kurt Jefferson, editor, along with Tobias Gibson, of Contextualizing Security, a reader, a collection of great articles on security and political science, sociology, philosophy. It's really a wonderful book. So I've heard some say that in view of the military catastrophe that's evolving for Putin by any standard, that he's just going to keep that powder semi-dry, not put too much more into that, and weaponize the gas thing. You know, the fact that that Europe depends on the pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline, and that he'll just wait until basically do a siege on Europe, an energy siege this winter. Does he have that ability? Can America come to the rescue? I don't think we've got the infrastructure in place to get liquid natural gas over there that quickly. What's the story there? Yeah. I mean, is he going to bring Europe to its knees?
Yeah, you're 100% correct, Randy. Your analysis is spot on. This Putin's been playing let's weaponize natural gas, liquefied natural gas and oil for a long time. I gave a paper on this at a Hancock Symposium at Westminster several years ago, when we had a guy who wrote a book on the end of oil. And I spoke on Putin, you know, and it was interesting, the individual who wrote the book, I'm forgetting his name, but he heard my talk and he said, oh, you know, Putin's a petrol bully, is what he called it. And I thought that was a really good term, because what's going to happen is they did this in Moldova. So at that time, this was 05, 06, they waited till like New Year's Eve to shut off the natural gas to the poor Moldovans. I mean, it's like, you know, 2 million people, 3 million people. It's not that big a country. It's the poorest in Europe. They have a GDP per capita of, at the time, it was maybe $1,000 a year per person. And these people are going to be frozen out during a very bitter winter. And that's what I think the Germans are concerned about. But I saw yesterday in some of the financial news, the Rosneft, one of the gas companies in Russia's profits have gone up 13% in the last quarter. So the sanctions have actually had weirdly the opposite effect. Yeah. And now the working class type parties and politicos in Europe, in Western Europe, in the European Union, the Germanys and the laborites and the socialists and others are saying, wait a minute, we're losing jobs because they're going to shut down the oil refineries, and the Russians are getting rich off tightening up the sanctions so they can charge more. So I think that's bad. I also think that, yes, a little bit of the Western media propaganda is coming out saying, two more quick points. One is saying, oh, look, you know, the Europeans are going to wear three coats and they want to take one for the team and all that. And I think there is some unity there against Russia and the bullying of Ukraine. And it's gone beyond bullying. I mean, it's a full-scale conflict. But the other part is on the American side that you allude to. I mean, Joe Biden has flat out said, we aren't going to even attempt to pump more gas and oil. So let's let inflation go through the roof. Let's not attempt to help our neighbors in Europe, who, I might add, are our Democratic Atlantic Alliance partners. And so we're contributing to the problem, too. And I don't mean that as a partisan shot. I just am saying, look, I mean, if we're really serious about confronting Russia as we would have in the Cold War, you got to think about the economic tools, too. But for some reason, the current POTUS 46 has said that's off the table, when our own economic and gas and oil situation is in peril. It ties to food, it ties to everything else. And I know you're better studying on the domestic side than I am on this, but boy, it's a mess. And you know, leadership is found wanting, in my opinion, in this context.
Well, that's a great stepping off point, because I have been so concerned about the huge backfire of policy in the West, not only here in the States, but obviously across the pond, as you just described, in Western Europe, where we thought that these sanctions were going to punish Putin, and it's actually making his coffers just richer than he could ever imagine. So when we come back, if you can spend a little more time, Kurt Jefferson, I'd like to talk with you about the compounding effect of China being that outlet for additional purchases. They're buying his oil and his coal and his gas and whatever else. And the friendly relationship, as we saw at the summit between Xi and Putin this week. And maybe we can talk about how that plays into not only the Ukraine situation, our interaction and our strategic future with China, because it just seems like a colossal mess. I hope you can help us unpack it, if you can spend another segment with me.
Absolutely. Love to, Randy. Thank you.
Kurt Jefferson joins us, author of Contextualizing, or editor of Contextualizing Security, a new book out on all of the great things that, well, not so great, but topics that need to be great in front of our mind. Let's put it that way. And we'll step aside, take a break here on 101.9941 News Talk STLB. Back with you after a few short words. Stay there, guys.
Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side.
Well, welcome back to the program, 828, as we continue our conversation with Dr. Kurt Jefferson, political scientist and expert on security matters across the globe, and trying to sort out what in the world's going on in Ukraine, Russia, China. What does it mean for us? This week in Uzbekistan, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping met, and, some pretty affirming statements, Kurt. Xi to Putin, quote, "We are ready to team up with our Russian colleagues," close quote. Is China now in the global driver's seat? Have they taken over from the U.S. in terms of leverage?
You know, I think it's a good question, Randy. I'm not sure. I have a good answer for that. I think the Russia-China relationship is so complicated because they share such a long border together. They've had a historical weird relationship. China, as it evolved after Chairman Mao came to power on October 1, 1949, had kind of a client state status with the Russians, Joe Stalin. I mean, they basically kind of dictated to Chairman Mao what to do until the Chinese got the bomb around 1962. And then in 68 or 9, they fought a short skirmish along the border of northern China. And I think they've had kind of a cat and mouse relationship. Of course, there's no question that there's an element of realpolitik here, Henry Kissinger type. You go back to 1970, 71, people our age remember even the turn by Nixon to China and Russia in the detente type of thing with Russia and the normalization with Red China. So I think, yes, the big twist I wanted to say today on your program was, one of the things a lot of Americans don't understand is in the younger generations, especially in China, there's a growing nationalism. It is not rooted really in Soviet or Chinese communism or Maoism. Yes, of course, there's propaganda that Xi has ramped up to become kind of, quote, the new Mao. But the reality is there is this nationalistic, we're going to build more ports, we're going to build more ships, we're going to have warm water ports, we're going to expand the military. So I'm with you. It's dangerous, it's problematic, but it is rooted more in nationalism, not a global Marxist communism. And the same thing is kind of evolving out of the Kremlin as well, although I don't think the spirit has been infused in the people. If anything, the cosmopolitan European kind of spirit of multiculturalism and liberalization and democracy and all that is sunk into some of the mid-level elites in the culture in Russia. And that's why they're kind of, it's a little bit like what you see in the United States with freedom of speech, people not wanting to talk about issues because they're afraid they'll lose their jobs or what have you, if they're honest about, you know, whether they agree with the Biden administration on its policies and these kind of things. So the same thing in Russia, they're not going to count, they're not going to stand up to Putin because they don't want to be sitting in the pokey if they were to say something that was anti-Putin. So I would say, yes, Xi is in complete control, and there is a nationalistic development going on there. And that's why he and Putin are getting along. But it is the old foreign policy axiom of my enemy's enemy is my friend. If we can square off against the West and Europe, United States and Europe and NATO, then we can stand together, mm-hmm. given how big and yeah. how many resources we have.
So, you know, that's, Kurt, dare I say, that's the, I think the new, the frightening news I just heard from our talk today, there's been a lot of sobering things, but the frightening news is this nationalistic spirit among young people, like, you know, viva la China, viva la Russia, right? I have to talk about a mixed metaphor,
right.
But at the same time when America, well, so many Americans of the same demographic, the younger Americans would like to see this country and everything about its constitutional first principles destroyed. I mean, there's an anti-nationalistic fervor in this country that's pretty strong. Of course, not in flyover country where, you know, you're being heard today and perhaps where you're broadcasting from. But that's what worries me, is sort of the anti-American sentiment that seems to be picking up momentum, at least with the current leadership and those who support it, at a time when those countries are getting their act together, not to mention the economic power that China particularly is wielding with garnering all of the rare earth metals and all of the raw materials that we need for all the technological infrastructure. It just seems like a toxic brew that doesn't bode well for America. Am I too negative or not?
No, I think you're right. I think there has to be some sobriety thrown into this, I think. And here, Samuel Huntington, who was a Democrat, a Harvard political scientist, worked for LBJ, John F. Kennedy, wrote a book in 1957 called The Soldier and the State. And essentially in that book, he argues we need a guardian class in the Platonic and in the Plato book. Republic, the book called The Republic Sense, 2,500 years ago, he wrote it. And that is a class that is here to guard, and he's talking about the military. And the military is not here to be a warm fuzzy. It's not here to be social experimentation and all these other things. It's here to guard and be apolitical and defend the freedoms and the civil liberties and the constitutional developments in the Western countries, right? specifically the United States he was referring to. And I think that's something that, you know, Americans, I used to tell classes years ago, if you don't think that a coup d'etat could not happen, a rogue group of people or a band of military, what happened, could happen in the United States, like happened in Germany under Hitler, which was under the guise of a legal bureaucratic coup d'etat in 1933. If you don't think that could happen in the West in a mature democracy like the United States, think again. And I think that's the thing, is that you need, I'm with you, we need to get back to recognizing that, you know, employees, leaders, others in, you know, academia, I posted this on LinkedIn this week, a piece on in Britain where the commentary about the Queen passing, there was some things about freedom of speech that were shut down. Now, Britain, I have my own stories there. I went to take a picture in 1990. I was traveling over there of the law courts, which were the former parliament building until 1707 in Edinburgh. Take a picture, and I had a bobby come up to me, a British police officer, say, you snap another picture, I'm confiscating your camera. And I copped kind of an American attitude. Wait a minute, dude, I've got the right to take this. And he was like, no, you don't. We don't have freedom of speech. We don't have freedom of press. We don't have those individual freedoms. And he was thinking, he thought I was casing the joint for the IRA or what have you. But
holy cow.
You know, we forget, you know, and I was taking pictures to show my students and whatever, but But basically, we forget that those civil liberties are, as you say, are really important, and that this is a situation that, you know, we've got enemies out there lurking, not wanting what's in the best interest of the globe, but in their own self-interest. And I'm not saying the people of China or Russia. Unfortunately, there are a lot of issues there. I've been to China twice, and it's a wonderful place, and the people are tremendous. I've worked closely with lots of Chinese academics and others, but the party has taken that system and bureaucratized it and changed it. And now you've got an underpinning of nationalism seeping into the system. And I have Chinese friends who say, look, Kurt, this isn't good. This is a mixture of Marxist Leninism and nationalism that can only end in one direction. And that's not a good direction. So, I do think the positivity is if the United States can continue to stand for what we stand for, you know, capitalism, democracy, free markets, freedom of speech, press, religion, assembly, to the petition the government for the redress of grievances. We get to do those things and keep promoting them. You know, that's not a panacea, but it's better than the alternative, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the Queen, and I've enjoyed watching the back and forth where, of course, the left is quick to pounce on the excesses and some of the abuses of imperialism. On the other hand, failing to recognize that the technological and, yeah, the political and sociological advantages of Western democracies, however they're constructed, were brought to countries that otherwise would not be where they are now had it not been for so-called evil imperialism, not to mention those aspirational values of the stability of a deep rudder that the monarchy, for all of its faults, represents. It's a stabilizing yep. rudder, and it's a patriotic and, dare I say, Christian rudder in a turbulent sea. And that's why I think you can have it both ways. I think this country can have it both ways. There can be recognition that tradition, slow evolution in terms of political change is what makes and has made this country great, all the while realizing that there is room for change and debate and healthy, vigorous differences. You know, you can have it both ways. I thought it was an interesting observance on the Queen's death, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate your commentary there, because the monarchy is an interesting, I mean, we could spend a whole hour talking about the monarchy. There was a study about 15 years ago that showed that monarchies are actually more stable, and I'm talking about monarchies that have some elements of democracy in them, are more stable than republics that don't have monarchies. Mm-hmm. And that's a very political science-y thing to kind of look at. But I do think that Churchill and his genius really felt that the monarchy was important. And it's really the same with the U.S. presidency. I mean, the presidency, half their job is head of state. It's recognizing diplomats. It's shaking hands with, you know, folks who are coming back from war, and it's planting right. trees, and it's all these kind of things. So there's no question about that. And in a place like Britain, the monarchy does play a kind of stabilizing role. Now I'm going to give you a quick story, a personal story. My great grandfather immigrated to Ellis Island from Scotland. His brother, his older brother, was the equivalent of an American university president at the University of Sydney. He was knighted by King George VI, Queen Elizabeth's dad, in 1946. Yeah. And the family back in Scotland, I write about this in my book, Celtic Politics, from 2011. The family back in Scotland was divided. Half said, you know, God save the king, because we're Britons. The other half said, no, we're Scottish nationalists, and he's not our king. So half the family said, we love the fact you're now Sir Robert Strachan Wallace, who this would have been, I guess, my great uncle or great great uncle. But the other half said, no, we don't believe in the monarchy. So it is complicated, but at the same time, it confers legitimacy on the system in a way that helps keep people ordered in the country. If you're just allowing political party to party back and forth, you see what happens when the as Plato said, when the majority gets power and they can start putting representatives in who want to give give, you know, give money out of the treasury and all that. And Jefferson warned about that. And we're seeing some of that today, unfortunately.
Well, Kurt, our time's up, but I tell you, I am going to, I'm so thankful that you were with me and were willing to spend so much time, because this has been a really very important and very, I think, revealing discussion about some of the realities, some of the real good SWOT analysis of what's going on over the pond and how it affects us here. To celebrate this event that is this interview with you, I am going to, hopefully you and I can join with others in the audience who enjoy scotch. I'm going to pull out the 16-year-old Macallan tonight and listen to this interview again, because it was an epic one. And I thank you for being with me. And I look forward to really digging into the book, Contextualizing Security. Thank you for editing along with Tobias.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tobler. It's always a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. And I appreciate your, you know, and I'm going to use a big word, perspicacious analysis when we talk. But I will pull out here in Kentucky, you can't call it whiskey. You call it bourbon, or they're going to, throw you under the bus. So I'll pull out a Maker's Mark or something like that and toast you as well. So, and
all right, we will
toast
do that
the memory time of Queen Elizabeth II. Thank you.
There you go. Beautiful. Hey, thanks so much, Kurt. Have a great weekend.
Take care.
There he is, Kurt Jefferson, a good friend and a valued colleague in the world of articulating what is important in the world. And I hope that our analysis and his commentary helps you in discussions you may be having about Ukraine and Russia and China. When we come back, we're going to talk with Kellyanna Brooking, a 14-year-old with Turning Point USA, the youngest president and ambassador of a chapter. And we'll be talking with her right after this as we wrap it up on the Tobler Show today here on 101.9 941 News Talk STL. Well, welcome back to the program. You know, I have been looking forward to this conversation since I knew I was going to be able to talk with Kellyanna Brooking, 14 years old, Turning Point USA's youngest president and ambassador from the Seattle, Washington area. Wow, talk about a diamond in the rough. That is Kellyanna Brooking. How you doing, Kellyanna? Thank you for joining me.
Hi, sir. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So you are a real phenomenon in the conservative movement and among young people who are, seeing the right way to look at things. And I think at a time when a lot of us older folks are thinking the country's going to you know where in a handbasket and all of the young people are progressive, man, you are a voice of clarion conservatism. How in the world did you get involved in the political movement and come to the way that you view the world? And of course, we'll talk about that, what that way is, but your interest, how did it all evolve?
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And what got me involved in politics was obviously here in Seattle, summer of 2020, we had Chop Chaz, as I'm sure you know, which was defunding the police, and people were treating the police officers horribly, and our police were being actively defunded. And growing up, I was never taught about politics per se. I was just taught to respect those who helped to serve to make our lives safer. So when I saw that this was happening in Seattle, and I saw the way that local journalists and news anchors were covering the issue, they were glamorizing the issue instead of bringing attention to the issue. And to me, it wasn't necessarily a political thing at first. It was just morally wrong. So I knew that I needed to speak out against it because nobody else was. And then going forward, later that summer, I read Tommy Lahren's book, Never Play Dead, and I realized that what was happening with the defunding of the police movement and ACAB and the way that kids and people in Seattle were treating this issue, I realized it very much was a political thing, and I need to speak out against it.
Well, I'm just amazed. I mean, I am just so, I'm just so thrilled that you're so active, and you're already an accomplished public speaker. You have your own website, KellyannaBrooking.com, and now you have, what is it, a podcast now? Is it a weekly, or how often are you podcasting now?
I have a 30-minute talk show called A Few Words where I film, and those will be uploaded throughout the year.
Uh-huh. It's called A Few Words, huh?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you formed your Turning Point USA hub when you were 12 years old.
Yes, I did.
Tell me what's involved in that, and then what kind of events do you do, and what kind of membership are you gaining? I would imagine with your charisma and charm and articulation, you probably are building quite an organization. Tell us about how you're growing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we've done food drives, clothing drives. We've done things with churches, and we've gone to numerous political events and speaking events and rallies here in Washington State. And unfortunately, we used to have quite a few members. We used to meet regularly, and we used to have a lot of people. And this was when I was in, I think, this is when I was in seventh grade. And there's a lot of older people involved in it that were going into their freshman year of high school. And when they went to school, they got blue-pilled, and they lost hold of that conservative values that they used to have, that their parents taught them and what they grew up with. Because when you go to a public school in such a liberal dominated area, it can be easy to be easily persuaded or brainwashed by what the school is saying, which is the liberal agenda. So we lost a lot of members during that time. But there were some people that still stuck around, and we still got to go to events and do numerous things, which was awesome. We went to Florida. We went to a Turning Point event, so that was awesome. But unfortunately, our members definitely went down when they went to public high school.
Well, I can see, though, a potential synergy between, parents of the more conservative persuasion that want to be there to sort of team with their children as they see more critical race theory and 1619 and gender ideology creep into the curriculum, banding together with organizations like yours, because I would imagine there's probably, if not overt, at least some implicit intimidation when you do, maybe write a paper for a history or civics class and, show your opinion. Isn't this a nice time with parents after pandemic becoming more aware of some of the liberal indoctrination to sort of help defend the kids or not?
I think that in more conservative areas where there are parents heavily involved in school boards and constantly involved in schools, and they are raised on those Christian conservative values, and they help their kids to go on that path too, I think that's fantastic. But sadly, I think most parents in Washington State are they've only been really looking at school board since the pandemic started. And I think most of their parents will vote in a leftist way, because the way that the school board and the liberal schools will push it is that the teachers union needs help. Feel bad for the special education kids and these poor teachers that had to go through the pandemic, when really majority of the teachers in Washington State, when they were still getting paid when they were at home or not. That's why they kept voting for the mask mandates, and they kept voting for they didn't have to go back to school to genuinely teach. And it's really sad that that's what's happening with the teachers union. Continue.
Do you go to a private school or public school?
I go to a public school.
Okay, so do you feel comfortable when you are outspoken in a way that maybe you suspect, or maybe it's clear, are at odds with your teacher's perspective? In other words, is there a civil relationship, and do you feel like you penalized in grading or, in any other way by your view that may be at odds with most of the teachers?
I've recently been very fortunate to be able to move to a more conservative area of Washington State. So at this school, I feel comfortable. We have outspoken conservative school board members, and the area and the community is pretty conservative. But I do still live in Washington State. I still go to Seattle regularly, where people know me and they target me. And I can definitely speak on last school year. There's no way that I was ever felt comfortable doing what I was doing, but I still did it anyway, because if I didn't do it, nobody else was going to. And here in Seattle, it's so interesting, because not only are my peers treating me this way, but grown adults are doing it as well.
Wow. I tell you, this is amazing. Well, you are a story of courage and inspiration, and I think aspiration for many folks who are thinking like, wow, all I got to do is get out there and organize and start, a nucleus, and next thing you know, things can grow. I know it's heavy lifting, but you seem absolutely bound and determined to make sure that you're making a difference in your community. And I have a feeling we're going to be hearing a lot more from Kellyanna Brooking as the years go by. And you have a political science interest, I imagine, in your future, don't you?
Yes, my plan of right now is majoring in communications and minoring in political science.
All right. Well, I hope you'll visit with us from time to time, Kellyanna, and become a friend of the show, because we're going to be following you at kellyannabrooking.com, and I'll be listening to your show too as you post new episodes. Thanks for being with me this morning on the Randy Tobler Show so early. Appreciate it.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it. God bless.
God bless you too. Oh boy, that's great. What a way to wrap the show, huh, Leah? I hope you enjoyed that, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you, Leah, for focusing us on Kellyanna today. That's uplifting. Yeah. Remember, folks, that while those folks up in D.C. can be laughable, sometimes you want to cry, resting on faith, family, and freedom, we will continue to sustain this greatest country the planet's ever seen. Thanks for being with me. We won't see you next week, but we'll see you the following week here on News Talk STL. Take care.
In the beauty of the Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me as he died to make men holy. Let